we observed that there's antibacterial soap in the restrooms here. It means that it kills bacteria on contact.
Uh-huh.
And isn't that a contradiction?
A sentient being. Okay. Buddha would define a sentient being as a mind possessor, and that's the word in Tibetan. The Buddha would say there's not an atom of space you won't find sentient beings, so our bodies are pervaded by all kinds of sentient beings, more than we'd say in our world. I mean, they always, even in our world, they say under our armpits, like a zoo, just our armpit, everywhere there are beings. So even if you don't, I mean, there are trillions of sentient beings, even the food we eat probably kills half of them, they probably don't like the food we eat, so we're probably killing sentient beings all the time. And so it doesn't follow, the next point is it doesn't follow that something that moves and lives and responds to the sun is a sentient being. And it doesn't follow that something we can't see isn't a sentient being. So it's quite complex. But the point, therefore, given that the Buddha says we're living in this insane asylum where we are harming each other all the time, the only thing we can do is have the wish not to harm anything that we know is a living being. The best we can do is that. So if you intentionally know that something is in your body and you decide to kill it because you hate it, that's called killing. But if you're trying to be healthy and you know, you realize anyway, just even driving the car, breathing, you're killing beings, but you don't wish to, but you have the wish not to harm if you can. This is the best we can do, and already that's pretty amazing. You know? Yeah. What else, people? Yes. Yes.
So I found myself thinking about my relationship with mosquitoes, which
that's right.
is not a particularly fond one.
Exactly, and there's so many that we have fondness for.
And I don't, you know, hate the mosquitoes. And
well, you do. You have aversion for them. No, it's sort of bare bones, the way we all are. It's either aversion or attachment. If they're delusions, okay. Or it's a love and affection, which is virtue. So most of us have delusions. It's either aversion or attachment. There's no other option, virtually. It's not indifference, believe me.
Okay. All right.
Go on.
Well, and so... So I'm just going to run by my way of thinking about this
okay.
and just have you respond to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I think, well, you know, I could let these mosquitoes that are in the tent with me live because I didn't bring my lotion to, you know, get them to stay away from me. And likely I'm going to have an allergic reaction to those mosquito bites because that's what happens.
Okay.
And so then I'm probably going to be aware of them for the next week, you know, when they itch and
that's
blah,
right.
blah, blah.
That's right.
And then I think to myself, well, you know, that's going to be a distraction from me being present with whatever life, you know, brings, you know, to me. And so I think, well, it's more important for me to be more present and not distracted with these bites than it is for...
Sure. hey, honey, you're just saying what we all think. But the point is, it's all a question of perspective. It's all a question of view. So if these were like little creatures that were very precious to you, like your poodle or something,
mm-hmm.
or like your babies...
I have a poodle.
Okay. So just translate mosquito to poodles and then see how you'd think. And because they're the source of your attachment, you would learn to encompass them into your world. Listen, it's never easy, but all these things that we say are based upon a series of assumptions in our world that mosquitoes and cockroaches and rats, we call them vermin because they're things that upset human lives. We assume, because this is our culture, and I have to say, not being rude, but giving an historical source is coming from mostly the Christian teachings, which means they don't have a soul, and God made them as us as the boss to do with as we wish. That's a strong thing in our history for centuries. So all of this coming together, then obviously there's this view that it's okay to kill them, and then we give all these logical reasons why we can and shouldn't have no choice but to. But as soon as you change your mind and come up with a new view that maybe they're sentient beings and they were their mother in the past life and they were human and I've been a mosquito, I mean, it just begins to change your perspective, that's all. It's not an easy thing. So we do what we can to avoid harming. This is the fundamental. I mean, if you take one instruction from all the Buddha's explanation, get right down to the essence of one thing to tell someone if they want to know what's the essence of what he says, he would say, don't harm a sentient being. And all this is this is related to your own happiness and suffering, because he says suffering, our suffering, now comes from harming in the past. So all of it, for our sake and the sake of others, the one instruction is don't harm sentient beings. And he gives all his logic for this. So it's not an easy one when we're coming from a very different perspective. And the general other thing I want to say is we, because we're so clever and talented and creative, as soon as we change our view, we will be very creative in finding a method, finding a solution to the problem. Do you see? So what we, even our own culture, we would have come up with marvelous methods to get rid of mosquitoes without harming them. If we'd been, because we've got these brilliant minds, we could do this. It's just that the usual view is get rid of mosquito means killing a mosquito. Whereas if we had care for mosquitoes, but we didn't want to be bitten by them, which is fine, we would have found brilliant ways, because we are so brilliant, to get rid of mosquitoes without harming them. Would have been perfect for everybody. And so I think we are clever, and lots of people who do decide now they don't want to harm sentient beings are coming up with very clever ways to get rid of the rats and get rid of all the creatures without wishing to harm them. It's possible because we're intelligent. Do you see my point?
Yep.
It isn't an easy one. And again, remember, this is not a moralistic issue. This is not someone up there saying, don't do this, otherwise you're a naughty girl and I'll punish you. It's learning to recognize, like with food, that it will bring consequences to you. And this is the first step that really demands that we look at it. Rather than, oh, you mean I'm not allowed to kill? Well, who do you think you are? You know, I'm going to do what I like. Which is how we think of morality, you know. So it's stuff to think about. It's not that easy either. Who else?
Venerable Rabina, could I ask you a question?
Where are you?
All the
poke your hand up. I can't see you. Yes, this precious one.
Consciousnesses that are ready to be reborn. If women are not having babies, and these consciousnesses have to reincarnate within, 49 days?
Uh-huh.
What happens to them? That, you know, there are so many who want to get into that womb.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm just wondering. They go to hell, bro.
I mean,
thank you.
Well, if the door's closed, you can't get in, can you? I mean, I've got so many things to say just to that, answer that. It's like, all I'm going to give you is the basics of what Buddha says, you know. Billions of sentient beings, we all create the cause, to be born where we get born, to meet the beings we meet, to have the karma to do this, have this, not have this, do this, whatever, you know.
It's like mind-boggling.
I know, it seems all a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? But all you can do is think about it. So if there's no human womb available, you don't get one, do you? What can I say? What else, people? Huh? Something? That's all that came out of your discussion? Okay, what can I say? It means I've got to talk more. Okay. So what we've done is try to look at the nuts and bolts of Buddha's view. Consciousness, continuity, beginningless. Everything we think and do and say is karma, the law of karma. Everything we think and do and say programs the mind that produces the future experiences of that mind, of that person. There are realms of existence we get born into these. Suffering, happiness, blah, blah. You know, and Buddha's whole view is finding the methods, locating himself the causes of suffering and finding the methods to stop suffering and locating the causes of happiness and finding the methods to get happy. Really, simple way of putting it, you know. And then how he defines happiness as freedom from suffering, all the suffering, nirvana, all these words, his business, his state of mind. And his main point in terms of the mind, of course, as we're talking, going into the more details of causes of suffering, is these neuroses in our mind. These are the main causes of suffering for all sentient beings, he says, now and in the future, because on the basis of these delusions, we do things to harm others, and we set up this process, you know. And then the other one to say it really is we have this intense karmic history. It's the only way to put it. Strong history with countless sentient beings, because we are social beings in all the realms. The animals, look at us, the humans, look at us. We're interacting with others. And we know that all those others we can divide into enemies and friends and strangers. So enemies are those who harmed us in the past, and we harm them, and so we keep on the ball rolling. Friends are those who have been kind to us, and then strangers are the ones we couldn't care less about. So we keep doing all, we keep creating this history with sentient beings. Is the way of putting it. Meeting again and again and again. Doing to each other the things we've done in the past. You know, this kind of thing. This is how Buddha says. So the whole point is, he's saying we can be free of suffering. And so if we want to be free of suffering, the first step is to want to be free of suffering. Be sick of suffering. Up to your teeth in suffering. Fed up with it. Label it the way he labels it. And then start to look into the methods of stopping suffering. And that basically in the Buddhist view is abide by the laws of karma, as he puts it. Be a nice person. Do as your grandma said. Don't harm others. You know, you've got a basic little checklist in the beginning of simple instructions. Don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't badmouth. Don't misuse your body and your speech to harm sentient beings. This is grade one junior school level of practice. The basis of it is quite different from the usual one. I mean, if you're a good communist, you do the same thing. If you're a good Christian, you do it because God said. If you're a good little mummy's girl, you do it because mummy said. Well, Buddha's saying to do it, same as mummy and God, but for a different reason. Not because he says, I'm doing it. Not because he says, I'm saying to do it. But because he's found from his own experience, like a doctor, that if you do this, it'll cause you suffering, honey. So my suggestion is you don't do it. He's giving us advice, you know. So that's up to us to look into that. So like I said, the very first level of practice then, which ends up benefiting others as well, is you stop killing, stop bad-mouthing, stop harming. We do our best to do this. It turns you into a marvelous person because you're stopping following your anger and attachment, which drive the actions we do with our body and speech to harm others. So it's a method for you to become a better person, a kinder person, a wiser person, a more relaxed person. And the bonus in the beginning is other sentient beings get a life. So as Lama Zopa says, all the rats and roaches will have a party because you leave them in peace, you know. So it benefits both. And then you can keep moving on this and get to the root of the problem in high school, if you like, the more advanced level, and become your own therapist, get into the actual nature of your own mind and start unraveling and unpacking all the nonsense in our own mind and identifying precisely the actual causes of suffering, the mind, the delusions, learning using the meditation skills, developing, understanding Buddha psychology, going deep inside, and then eventually uprooting completely all the misconceptions. And then you see everyone else is in the same boat, and you develop the compassion wing as well, benefit others, become a bodhisattva, blah, blah, blah. That's how they talk. So let's go into karma a bit more then, and how the notes I've just done, the course notes, which will be ready printed tomorrow. You can have it as a PDF to download. You can get it from the website, it seems, tomorrow. It's going into detail there about how we create karma and how we purify karma, and then the practice to how to do it. In the notes. So we've done this in the past. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it now. Well, like I said, you know, we give this example of Brad. Where's Brad? Is he there still? He's gone. Okay. Okay, whoever, Brad, Dan, whichever, Tracy, whichever one we use, same with all of us. But, you know, there's four ways. Our actions, action meaning karma, mental actions, verbal actions, physical actions, all of which together leave these imprints, these programming in our mind. There are four ways in which these things can ripen. And, of course, this is the simple principles. The actual technicalities of it. The technicalities of it are quite complex, like anything, you know. You can learn the simple principles of botany, that you put a seed in the ground, it'll bring a flower, or you can be a really skillful botanist and learn the details, the subtle details of it. And eventually, in long term, one's own practice and study would involve that. But we start with the basic principles. So there are four ways that any of the actions we do, every moment, every microsecond, positive, negative, neutral, will leave imprints in the mind and can ripen according to the various conditions coming together. One is the type of rebirth. The next is the tendencies within your mind in that rebirth, your personality traits, your Hitler traits, your Mother Teresa traits, whatever they might be, the anger, the hurt, the fear, the low self-esteem, the rage, the aggression, the lust, the psychosis, the compassion, the wisdom, whatever it is, being good at piano, being good at football, whatever. These are all tendencies. Mummy and daddy can be good at these, and they can teach you. But it's what Buddha's saying is, okay, I'll finish the four. The third one is the experiences, the parents you get, the people you meet, how they treat you, whether you're seen as a garbage person, kind person, whether people believe you, don't believe you, all of this. And the fourth one is called environmental results, even the very way the physical world. You see, in the big picture, in the long term, in all the texts, in the literature in Buddhism, there are these detailed descriptions of the nature of the physical universe. And as I said, they use the model that it's made of the four elements, which is just as how we, our scientists, talk back in the Middle Ages. Now we talk about a million other kinds of elements. So that the Buddhist view would be these elements have no power from their own side. You see, you've either got the Christian teaching, which says that God made it all, and I'm not complaining, I'm just saying it's a different view. You've got the materialist view, which is everything is merely the physical, and they've got their own laws, and we're trying to work out how that impacts upon people and what consciousness is and blah, blah, blah. Then you have this other one, if you like, another one, Buddha's view. So you've got the physical world, the four elements, and then you have minds. And there's an intimate relationship between these, and they talk about this especially in the more esoteric teachings in Buddhist Tantra. This intimate relationship between the four elements and minds. Every mind has its own set of four elements. There's the mind and the four elements with which it is conjoined. And because of the impact of whatever minds do upon those elements, internally and then externally, Buddha's actually really saying in the long term that even the way the world out there manifests in front of us, ugly, beautiful, stinky, nice, gorgeous, sublime, sunsets, war zones, it's not separate from us. It's the result of that's the result of a collective karma of the group of people who experience that. So even the way the elements even manifest is the main cause of this. Is not their own law. They've got their own laws, but the energy, if you like, being vague about it, that causes it is not a creator, but is the collective, is minds impacting upon it. They have all these detailed descriptions of this process, like I said, in all the literature. So the type of birth you got, kind of the house you join, the rat house, the spirit house, the hell being, the human, whatever you want to call. And then the tendencies in that mind, the experiences within, you know, the kind of the interdependence with others, how you're seen, how you're treated, whether you only ever hear ugly things. You know, many of the friends I have in prison, when they wrote to us, you can see that they, in their lives, had never hardly even heard a kind word. Have an environmental karma, being surrounded by mean people, ugly people who see them as horrible, treat them horribly. Everything's ugly and violent, you know. I remember one guy, I always quote this, he went to the dentist one day, they took him out, it was a medium prison he was in, he had to go to the dentist, they took him, you know, to the dentist, outside, and the nurse said, "How are you today?" And he burst into tears. A person said a kind word to him, it was quite a surprise, you know. Some people just never hear good words. This is the result of actions such that all you hear and see is ugly things, or indeed beautiful things. But we don't ask the question for why good, beautiful things, we just assume it's our right, this is our trouble. But all of it, like I'm sort of joking about the movie business, but it's a good analogy. The movie you set up before, the pictures you took, now you play them. You know, there it is, your life in front of you, your karmic appearance, as Bhutan Lama Zopa says. So what the point is, what's the implication of this? It's this great theory, nice philosophy, then what do you do with it? That's the point, isn't it? If it can't be applied in your daily life, well, don't bother filling your head with a brand new idea. Keep a bit relaxed, you know. So for a person who's trying to be a Buddhist, you're using this explanation as your basis of describing your life to yourself. So let's look at the philosophy we normally have. You know, Dan comes along and mean to me. Then I go home crying. Mummy, Dan was mean to me. Such a creep, this bloke at school. He's so horrible. I didn't do anything to deserve it. I was just being nice, and there he comes along and is mean to me. So then this is the normal view. You think you're an innocent victim. You didn't ask to get born. This wretched person comes along and is mean to you. And so our philosophy at the moment is that we don't know why it happened. I'm an innocent victim, which is within a small period, it's true. If you take the view, this is a really important point. If you take the view that your mummy and daddy made you, that Robina absolutely began in her womb, then I've never met Dan before, then it's correct to have this response that we have. How dare he hit me? Who does he think he is? I don't deserve this. I don't ask to get born. I've done nothing to do with him. It's true within a period of this life. I've never met him before. It's true. But if you take the Buddhist view that you did meet him in the past, and now you're getting your own stuff back. Oh, Dan comes along. Oh, Mummy, he's so divine, this beautiful boy, Dan. He helped me. He's so sweet. He's kind. You can trust him. He's not trying to jump on me. He's a nice person. You start to laugh. Whatever. But you see, we don't go, wow, what have I done to deserve a kind person? I have done nothing. It can't be possible. No, I don't understand this. Why do good things happen to me, Mummy? Cry, cry. I don't think so. But the point is, the view, the response we have now to things, if you look at the words of our responses, it's the words of an innocent victim. I'm not being mean here, but it's so clear if we look at it. But because it feels for us so real and so natural, and because if, let's say, we are a materialist person who doesn't have a religion, then it's we would say, I don't have a belief. No, I don't believe anything. I just, you know, see the world as it is. We actually believe that this is just the way the world is. We don't even look at what our assumptions are, what our views are. We don't question those views. We just think it's the truth that Mummy made me. We therefore think it's the truth that I'm an innocent victim. This is the way the world responds automatically every single day. So all we're doing here is trying to look into this and look at the assumption of the thought, how dare you do that to me, I don't deserve it, I've never met you before, it's not fair, poor me. And that's the typical view of ego. Lama Yeshe would call ego the self-pity me. It sounds cruel, but it's profound, if we hear it. So all we're doing is taking Buddha's view here, which gives us a bigger window of space. And he says, hey, baby, you've got a mind that goes way back, and so has Dan. And guess what? You'd never meet this bloke at school if you'd never met him before. You wouldn't notice him. He'd walk right past you. You'd go, who, Dan, who, who's he? But no, you've got some history together, so we bump into each other. And then I respond to what he does. And then whatever he does to me, it is Buddha says this, it's an impossibility that he'd do anything kind to me or anything unkind if I hadn't created the cause. In other words, it's a completely interdependent scenario. He's doing it to me. You see, we ask the question, why did that happen to me? But they say, oh, well, you know, Dan's a creep because his poor mother beat him and it's not his fault. Let's say, for example, that's the example we use, why Dan was mean to me. But that's only the answer to why Dan is mean. Why is he mean to me? That doesn't answer that. And the Buddha says he's mean to you, Rabina, because you're mean to him. Simple. That sounds a bit simple. There's history. We've got strong history. Strong history together. So, you know, if you came along around the corner and just saw me punch Dan in the nose, immediately you'd say that, how dare you punch him in the nose, really? Who do you think you are? But if you'd come a second before, you would have seen him punch me in the nose. Then you go, how dare you punch her in the nose? Well, you know, if we take this bigger window, we've been punching since the beginning of time, you know. Meet again, punch again. Meet again, kiss again, you know. But keeping thinking we're innocent victims, and I have nothing to do with me, I'm innocent victim, mummy made me and I had nothing to do with it. The biggest way to say about the suffering, and this takes time to see it, the way Buddha's talking about how ego works, suffering, is that this feeling of being this person plonked into this horrible movie, have had nothing to do with it, you've no idea why you're here, you don't know why it's happening, you don't have any sense that you've got any responsibility for it. I mean, no wonder we live in fear, because that's what we believe is true. And the Buddha's view is, it isn't. He would say, it isn't like that. We all come fully programmed into these busy, busy scenarios, picking up where we left off before, carrying on the nonsense, continuing to believe we're innocent victims, continuing, therefore, to perpetuate more suffering, to get more punches, etc., etc. Or more kisses, if we're lucky. So it's got such implications, you know. There's a nice, interesting theory, but the experiential implications of it are really tasty. So the bottom line is, I listen to this view, let's say, then I think, well, this is interesting. And so then what the first step has to be, well, I have to look into my own self and see, it's true, I don't like suffering, and I do like happiness. This is bare bones, really simple starting point. Something high and cosmic and special. Nothing to do with compassion yet. It's accepting a fundamental thing that all beings, you can see, it drives all beings. The wish to be happy, the wish not to suffer. The wish to be happy, the wish not to suffer. The wish to be happy, the wish not to suffer. So all we're doing here is giving Buddha's explanation of what happiness is and what causes it, and what suffering is and what causes it, which is a very precise presentation in the Four Noble Truths. So then deciding, as I, in my case, I have, to take this on board as my view, my way of explaining my experiences. So it's in the same that if, for example, I was a went to a Chinese doctor, they'd give one explanation of my health. I go to a Western doctor and they'll give me another explanation. So it's up to me which one I decide to use, isn't it? And so there'll be a lot of different implications from these different models. It's up to me to choose the explanation. Well, I'm choosing to have the Buddhist explanation for what life is, what happiness is, what suffering is, what causes it. And so then where you put your money where your mouth is, you just don't say, oh, I went to the Chinese doctor today, and you quote what she said, but meanwhile don't do anything about it. Well, don't waste the time. The reason is to put that into practice. So here, if you're putting into practice these philosophical theories, it means when you recognize you don't want suffering and you do want happiness, then you're starting to take on board Buddha's view of what it is and what causes it. So his first step is, and what I'm telling you, Rabina, that I've found from my own experience, that if you kill, lie, steal, this, that, which is called harming a sentient being, and then you look behind it and see into your mind. So, the first step is, what is a negative action? It's that which harms a sentient being. The Christians say it's that which says God says you shouldn't do. It's a different definition. The Buddhist one says it's a natural law. If you do a bit of research in this room, we'll discover very simply that no one likes being harmed. So we can deduce, therefore, that's what a negative action is. It's one that harms another. And then we look into the mind a bit more deep, like we've been doing, and we start to look into what occurs. This is how we create karma. Let's go into more detail now. intention, the I will kill the mouse. Why? What's behind that, Rabina? Well, I don't like mice. That's called aversion. Then I do the action and the mouse dies. That's called a complete action of killing. And because of what's in the mind behind the action, which is called aversion, that's what makes it negative when I do it. You could just say Dan sees a mouse in the kitchen, doesn't see the mouse in the kitchen, doesn't even know there's a mouse there, and he blonks on it, and the poor thing squirts to death, you know. His foot did kill a mouse. He did not kill a mouse. You can't say that literally. His mind did not engage in it. He might never have even known he killed a mouse. So therefore, you say there's no, in the mind, there's no thought of I will kill, therefore there can't be a motivation, therefore there is no karma. This is logic. It doesn't mean you don't care and walk around not caring. No, you've got to learn to be aware and conscious and change the way we think and feel. But it's the mind engaging and what the mind does that gives the character to what we do and therefore what puts in, therefore what is sown in our mind and therefore what the results that come in the future. So the reason in the very first level of practice why Buddha says don't kill, don't lie, isn't to be a good girl because he says so, which is how we think of morality. It's because he says he's found from his own experience, like a doctor who knows about cancer, that if you smoke, you'll get cancer. If you kill, it'll harm you. And how it will ripen? One, it'll ripen in the lower realms as a suffering being, because it builds up, the energy builds and grows. You pollute your own mind stream, and then you're attracted to that. Two, it continues with a tendency. Three, you have the experience of being killed, and four, the environmental result. These are the consequences of all actions we do, all good and all bad. So he says, honey, if you don't want to suffer, I'm suggesting you stop killing, stop lying, stop bad-mouthing. Control your body, control your speech. First, just this. Begin to look at your mind, but the body and speech most. First, stop the causes, the main causes that will ripen as gross suffering for you in the future. Then that'll harness your energy enough for you to then start looking into your mind, which is where the root of it is, which is the delusions, the neuroses, the voices of ego, the misconceptions. Then you really get to the root of the problem. Then you really do the work, really become your own therapist. But you've got to control your body and speech first. Tiny little bit longer, Tracy. Hang on a tick, please. So then, you will control your body, speech, and mind. And so the consequences of this, first and foremost, and the motivation for this is so that you can stop suffering, because you are sick of suffering. So you've got to know you are sick of suffering. It's not some holy reason. It's practical. It's self-preservation. So guess what? The consequences of this is you will become a nicer person. If you control your body and speech, you become a nicer person. You become, therefore, more content. And guess what? Like I said, it's a bonus that the rats and roaches will have a party because you leave them in peace. If the whole world stopped harming each other, controlled their body and speech, we'd all be living in bliss. Can you imagine? So the first step is for your own sake. Yes, Tracy, so what's the question? Go. Good, yeah.
And when I write, it's a lot. I don't know. I don't think it comes from my heart, but I really believe, like, it comes from my mind, the things that I experience. And
yes. Like, speak into the mic, sweetheart, so they can hear you.
The things that I experience, and like when I'm really quiet and I'm not more or less concentrating, but just,
yes,
like relieving myself of,
yes,
those things that go on in my mind,
yep,
or the things that trouble me, that in that point when I'm writing, I'm truly honest, and those things that have come out are not really healthy. My writing is a lot about harming or,
yes,
like killing people. It's just the writing is about that.
I understand, sweetheart.
I feel within myself like being had some injustice or whatever.
I understand, Tracy.
I write those things.
Uh-huh.
I write them.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time,
uh-huh,
like it's like, how could you dare do that? Like, how could I visualize myself,
uh-huh,
hurting another individual?
Sure.
And then, like, and then even at the time, even if I should, like, the consequences of what it does to me.
So, what are the consequences?
Well, I mean,
does it make you more agitated or does it calm you down?
The consequence is that, like, I'll never have that freedom.
What, darling?
The consequence for me is that, you know, I'll never have that freedom, and the fact that
I don't understand what you mean, Tracy. Explain what you mean.
I mean, that it'll hurt me. I'm going to be hurt.
Oh, I see.
By hurting them.
But I'm trying to, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So you're telling me how you write this stuff, you know? Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm asking you then, do you know the reason you want to write all this down? What's the reason behind you?
It's in my thinking. It's really in my thinking.
I understand, but what, so, okay. So do these thoughts in your mind cause you to be upset and unhappy and stressed out?
Yes.
Do you realize? Okay. Do you have any understanding of why they're in the mind? From your point of view, I'm talking not
from
the Buddha's
point of view. Yes.
What? So okay. So then, do you have a feeling you'd like to change those thoughts? Do you feel you have the power to kind of to redo your mind and reprogram your mind and stop having unhappy thoughts because they make you miserable and try to have more positive? You have
that thought.
Okay. Well then, fine. Great. Good. So then go try and find, because that's what interesting point, Tracy. I'll give you the Buddha's explanation. Even how come we might have weird thoughts, terrifying thoughts. Some people, we're so terrified of our thoughts because weird stuff seems to come up. We have no clue in the ordinary perspective of where the hell this has come from. Mummy didn't teach us. Daddy didn't teach us. Okay, use an example. I'm thinking of some of these, serial killer in prison. I remember reading about him. And he said, since tiny boy, I'm not comparing him with you now, I'm just using an example, that since a tiny boy, he was compelled, not just to have thoughts, but he was compelled, he felt compelled hugely to torture creatures. And then he said he got pleasure from this. And so, of course, he grew up and he started torturing humans and eating them and cutting them open and putting them in the fridge and God knows what, you know. So he's kind of considered a monster. So he had no idea where these thoughts came from. So in an ordinary human world, we don't have a logical reason. So all I'm getting at is the Buddhist view is we come born into this life programmed with trillions of thoughts. So in the same way that you got this boy wanting to harm sentient, wanting to harm torture because he gets pleasure, another kid crying with compassion for the lice in his own head, like I mentioned before, and you having whatever thoughts you are, each one of us having our own big scenarios in here, they're all just thoughts that we brought with us, programmed from old habits, old past stuff. So from therefore the point of view would be, this isn't necessarily who we really are, because they're so powerful, we tend to think, well, this is who I am, what choice do I have, this is my mind, and so many people want to go mad because they feel they're such monsters, because they don't know where the thoughts come from. But if we can realize we just brought this old rubbish with us, that it doesn't define who we are, that we can change our mind, or we can learn to be more skillful and not follow the rubbish ones. So whether we want to torture somebody or stuff ourselves with a piece of cake, in the end, we're going to harm ourselves either way. So the whole first level of practice, which is not easy, is like learning to change our, not follow the rubbish thoughts, to train ourselves in discipline, to listen to the thoughts, to know what's there, but to have the courage not to follow the rubbish thoughts and attempt to control and grow and follow the positive thoughts. It's sort of like if when you sit down to play the piano and you've never learned it before, you don't spontaneously play beautiful piano. You've got to really force yourself to play every day, to discipline yourself, to have new thoughts which then express themselves as you playing the piano. You get my point here?
Yes,
so you're programming yourself into a musician. You program yourself into a cake maker. You program yourself into a good person. It's the same logic. But we've got to have the courage to know there's bucket loads of junk in our mind. And the first step is we better see them. But not give them power, not go, wow, far out, amazing. I'm not saying you do this. But to really recognize, okay, have your little basis here. Well, killing, lying, stealing, wanting to harm, that's not cool. That's going to harm me and others. I see I've got these thoughts. That's a drag, but see if I can harness them and not follow them and go to the opposite. And then this is the Buddhist approach. We have all these purification practices, which I'm going to talk about, to slowly mold our mind into the shape we want. Whether it's a musician, a cook, or a human, good, wonderful, moral person. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
It's up to us. So we need to see what's there. But we tend to feel, well, wow, this is who I am. This must be who I really am. And then we just become locked into it. And then that's why many people go crazy. Do you understand my point, darling?
I do. I really do.
Good, Tracy. Thank you very much. So our thoughts do count, you know, but we need to have an ability to judge whether they're valid or invalid. And this sounds very peculiar. It's just the same way, so I use ordinary examples. If you are learning the piano and you decide you're going to learn classical music, so you're going to play what Mr. Bach plays, you just don't go, oh, well, I can play what I like and call it Bach. It's not Bach. It's yours. That's okay. But if you want to play what Bach says, you've got to really harness your energy and learn his theories, what he says, and then you judge how you're playing according to what he says. It's not some absolute. You see what I'm saying? It's a referential thing. It's up to you to choose that. So here, if we choose to think of what the mind is, and we're using Buddha's model, then he's got this very simple model. Well, there's moral, there's immoral, there's positive, negative, neutral. It's pretty straightforward. A negative is one that harms another, and it's motivated by the wish to harm, or attachment, or anger, or hurt, which is what harms me. So I want to use that as my model, and then I observe my mind, well, I want to kill my father here. Instead of writing a novel about it, wow, far out, amazing, how special, I want to kill my father, I go, uh-oh, that's called killing. Well, that's not cool. But don't, we either hide it, and try and make it all go away, because you can't, you go mad. Or we put it up there like some special thing, and we think, far out, amazing, my thoughts are so special, where I want to kill. And then we go off and become an expert killer. Look at the world. No, you had your little checklist. Oh, that's not cool. Like when you're playing the piano, what does Bach say? Oh, I'm doing the wrong thing, I better fix it. Well, what does Buddha say? Okay, I'm going to agree with that one. Oh, I better not kill. So you learn to harness your energy. Don't follow it with your body and speech. And that itself is pretty tough, but that weakens the habit. If every time you say the word and do the action, that strengthens the habit. If every time you control the body and speech, it weakens the habit. It's hard work. Look at our pathetic little habits. We mightn't be torturers and murderers and rapists. You know, we look at the few little miserable little things we do. Look how hard it is to change habits. But we've got to have the courage to know then we're not set in stone. We don't have to give so much power to whatever's arising in our mind. It is arising. We must see it. But then we have this assessment. What does Bach say about it? Well, that's good. That's not. That's this. That's that. And then you turn to learn to play what he says. Well, here we're learning to use Buddha as our basis. And we live according to that. And eventually you get better and better at it. You don't even need to look at the music anymore because you know, because you've got your own wisdom. This is the approach, you know. And it's up to us whom we choose. We can become a communist if we like. We can become a killer if we like. It's up to us, you know, to decide whose instructions, or even we can decide to use our own, whatever we like. You know, but I'd rather not invent the wheel. I'd rather look at some experts and see what they do than decide which one to follow. Are we communicating here? So, okay, so creating karma then, how it works. I mean, again, simple points. And how we purify it. This is the main thing here. So using an example, this is the one I always use, is quoting this example of this little boy. The little boy, the son of my friend who was a fisherman. Remember the one I talk about all the time? I talk about this one. But it's a great example of showing how we even come into this life with certain tendencies. And then looking also at what we mean, bringing this together with what we think happiness is and feelings. All of this packaged together. You'll see it in this example. So there's this little boy. Okay, he was about 4, his mother said, I forget, something like, she told me about him. She'd been listening to some teachings about karma, and she came to me crying, and she said this boy of hers who died 5 years before, he was 29, he'd been a fisherman all his life, and she, you know, was sad and everything, just getting over the grief of this boy's death, and then she hears about karma, and she's, you know, oh my God, my boy spent his life killing sentient beings. Okay, lots of people do. So, it's like this. This is how you'd explain it. He was a little boy. There he was born. Okay, so if you look at the 4 ways that karma ripens, the first one, he got a human birth. So he had all this virtuous karma that ripened from the past life. He got a human birth. He got his nice mummy in California somewhere. Second, he was a very nice boy. Lots of good tendencies. He was kind. He was generous. He was intelligent. He was a lovely human being with many good qualities. But among all his tendencies, there was one called the wish to kill, which was, in his case, fish. Okay, so then he had lots of good experiences. The third type of karma, he had nice mummy and daddy, lovely, lovely friends, good people, all good stuff out there, good movie replaying, you know, from his own virtuous actions. And then he had good environmental, lived in a nice place by the river, blah, blah, blah. His life was the result of lots of virtuous karmic seeds of his. But this particular one called killing. Okay, so there he is, a little boy, and then one day he's taken fishing. So he was like magnetized immediately. It was like he fell in love with fishing. This is what happens. I went fishing with my father. You know, I didn't. I knew about fishing, but it didn't even arise a thought in my mind. I saw the fishing rods. I didn't think about it, but it didn't attract me. I didn't go, wow, Daddy, can I come fishing with you? And be so excited about fishing. So we sort of take this for granted and just think, oh, well, you have different preferences, you know. Because we don't know why one person likes fishing, one person doesn't. All this is the Buddhist explanation. So this little kid, he didn't know he liked fishing until he saw it. Like, you know, when I always remember the Romeo and Juliet movie, or I remember particularly Baz Luhrmann's version of it, you know? Oh, no, West Side Story. You know, 1960s, West Side Story. And Tony and Maria at the dance, the Sharks and the Jets, you know? And suddenly they see each other across the dance floor. And then everything else fades away. And all there is Tony and Maria. Do you understand? That's karma ripening. Like Dan and I, never met before, I see him all across the schoolyard, and I fall in love. We go, and we think of this magic and special and from blah, blah, blah. We just met, we bumped into each other again, you know? Or if it's, I can't stand the sight of him. Same thing. You see him, this monster, who's that ugly Dan? Oh my God, I'm going to go near him. Just the same. There's some history there. You don't notice all the rest. You know, the ones we like, the ones we don't like. The rest we couldn't care. We've got history with each other. We've got history with each other all the time. So there's this boy. He sees fishing and instantly attracted. So what's happening is this. Past life, he's been in the lower realms, okay? That's what the Buddha would say. And he'd finished that karma. So many countless lives of intense suffering, having, as a result, the fully ripened result, as they call it, of having killed in the past. That karma runs out like a petrol tank. The gas tank runs out. Then, like a miracle, one day, his virtuous karma ripens, another one, many millions of seeds in there, and he gets a human mummy. And all sorts of other good things ripen. They're all there, and he gets a good human life with good conditions, good tendencies, good experiences, blah, blah. But one of the ones is he's got the residual result left over from having done the killing in the past. He's got the tendency to keep killing. This is where the purification practice comes in. As Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do this practice every day, which we're getting to. And it's in the notes you've had, and you people know it. You've done it before, some of you, if you're not new to this. It's where you, so if everything that I'm experiencing now is the fruit of what I've done in the past, then I better do some weeding. Not just not sow more negative seeds, which is a not killing, not lying, not stealing. Not just not do more things, but actively try and pull out the seeds that I've planted in the past before they ripen as my suffering. You get ahead of the game, you know. You've got to do a bit of weeding every day. Do you understand my point? That's what the purification practice means. And you're going to hear it's very practical, very psychological. We've got to do this as well as not harm others. So, okay, we can deduce from this the fact that he had the tendency that he didn't make decisions never to kill again. He didn't make decisions never to kill again, which is part of the purification practice, which is the crucial one. I will never kill again. So obviously we can deduce that he hadn't had that wish, that thought, that intention, that programming. He hadn't consciously intended never to kill again. That's how come he woke up in this life with good stuff, but there was a residual result of killing, which was the tendency to keep killing, and that's the worst one. Now, Tracy talks about weird things in a mind. We all have this, and it's sometimes as scary as hell. We have no idea where this stuff comes from. And of course it scares the life out of us. Mummy didn't teach us. And the tragedy is, of course, if you get like, you know, this serial killer guy who actively went and did it because it was such a powerful drive. Everything in him drew him to do it. And this is the tragedy, because it gave him pleasure. And I'll talk about the fisherman in the same way, and you'll hear it. So, what's happening is this. The tendency is there. One day he meets the condition called fishing. And suddenly, it's like Romeo and Juliet meeting again. Suddenly you see Tony across the dance floor. And he just like looms large. Instant love. Instant falling in love. We all know this. You meet people you can't stand, or you just adore. Out of the blue, seemingly. Karma ripened. So he had karma with this activity. He saw it, and it was like it triggered his memory. He doesn't think of it this way, of course. Then what happens? Because he's familiar with it from having done it before, because you're familiar with Dan from a past life, and then you've got, in our case, Dan and I, let's say if I see him as gorgeous, we must have some virtuous karma there. So he looks nice to me, you know, and I see him as kind, and he treats me kindly. All this is the fruit of our past virtue. But with a fishing one, because you've done it before, the imprint is there, you meet the condition again, it triggers it, and then instantaneously, because you've done it as a habit, it triggers, and this is the problem, it triggers instantly, it triggers massive attachment. Anyway, we are driven by attachment. It's the default mode. It's like this motor in us. And its main energy is just dissatisfaction. We're always walking around feeling empty, wondering what it is that I must find to fill me up. The gross level, of course, is the object of the senses. You feel dissatisfied, kind of agitated. Oh, what is it? You open the fridge, you look at this, wheeze at that. Oh, I think I'll ring a friend, go to a movie. We keep grabbing at anything to keep filling us up to make us feel all perky, you know, because we don't know else how to feel happy. So for him, it was fishing. It looked delicious. He'd seen it before. He'd done it before. The habit was there. Attachment came along, and it's like he put his rose-colored specs on, and this thing looks completely divine, like from Romeo and Juliet, looking divine to each other. So, of course, whatever looks divine, you're super attracted to it. And then because whatever looks divine is instantly triggering a good feeling in you. And guess what? This is the point of the exercise. We are desperate junkies for good feelings. This is happiness. Moments of good feelings. Moments of good feelings is what we're desperate for. So, seeing fishing, which you've got a habit for, the memory is there, he runs towards it, it looks divine, it triggers a good feeling, so the logic is, oh, well, fishing must be good. Torturing must be good. Because, you know, the torturer, I remember one of them, years ago, one fellow in one state, with no death row, so he got 35 years or something for doing it, kills lots of people. BTK, remember BTK? Bind, torture, kill, in Kansas or somewhere. For 35 years he spent doing these bizarre scenarios of getting women, men, children, families, and in these weird sort of scenarios that he would create of torturing them. So he got incredible pleasure from it, what we'd call sexual pleasure. This sounds like monstrous to us. But pleasure is just pleasure. Pleasure is just happy feelings. And the tragedy is, okay, just stuff is with a cake, we think it can trigger a feeling, it's fair enough. Have nice sex, that triggers a nice feeling. But when it comes to killing fish or torturing people, that also triggers nice feelings because of the habit of having done it. That's the tragedy. And of course, because we're desperate junkies for good feelings, if the thing that you do that triggers very good feelings, which happens to be calling torture, you'll have to do it at night because no one's going to approve of it. Fishing is okay, the people in the world approves. Having sex is reasonable within certain limits. You get my point here? But if it's something that the world thinks is disgusting, like torturing, of course you do it in secret. Because you're going to get up, people, oh, if you want to kill poodles instead of fish, you'd be in big trouble. You better do it at night. You'll be hanged. You see my point? So we've got all these tendencies. And they're from having done them before. That's all. Nothing rocket science. But the tragedy is, because we're addicted to believing that that is the cause of the good feeling. We want the good feelings, and we don't know how to... The only way to put it is we just don't know how to access our own capacity for good feelings, which is called happiness. We don't know how to access our own good, our capacity for good feelings. You get my point here? So we're like this kind of waiting to be triggered. I've got to have buttons pressed, you know? I don't know how to do it myself, so I've got to get a cake in the mouth, or a boy, or kill a fish, or torture somebody, depending on your habit. You sort of see my point. So, of course, because we're desperate for the good feelings, and a person who's got the habit to kill fish, the habit to torture, this is the tragedy, then they're compelled to do it again. Their minds are full of it, obsessed, you know, and they actually go and do it. And then it does trigger a good feeling. This is a tragedy. So then, of course, even though you know it's wrong, you can't stop doing it because the habit is so deep. This is why people, pedophiles, rapists, you name it, you know. And us and our pathetic habits of eating too much cake or something. Are we communicating here? So, you know, it needs a lot of analysis to reprogram your mind, not to follow your feelings, in other words. And this is a scary one for us because we think feelings are everything. If it feels good, it must be good. We're convinced. It's just nonsense. It's like infantile. It's like you're trying to play Bach. And you've chosen to play Bach. And you play any old note. Oh, I like that. It feels good. Well, then don't call it Bach then. Put the music away and do what you want. But you're trying to channel Bach into you by following his methods. That means disciplining, going against the feeling to play this note or that note. You've chosen to play these notes because you've decided that's a pretty good way to play piano. That's a tough one. So here we're choosing to practice morality, which means don't follow your feelings. And the feeling is just because you've done it before, and it gives a good feeling, it doesn't follow, it's moral, it doesn't follow, it's valid. And certainly for the Buddha, if it is harming another, it is guaranteed it will only bring suffering in the future. So it really needs to be thought about carefully, which means it means discipline, struggle, change, but not to panic about it, Because we're capable of doing anything. And there's no karma you can't change. There's no thought we can't change. There's no thing that's set in stone about us. Just very strong habits, that's all. With me, people? Okay. So then how do you purify all these old rubbish, you know? Well, it's psychological, just like you create karma with your mind. As Lama Yeshe says, you create positivity with your mind. So we can create negativity. I mean, we create negativity with our mind. We can purify it by creating positivity with our mind. The more we think, and Tracy's example is a good one, the more we think that whatever arises in our mind is just thoughts. Don't underestimate. They're powerful, but they are only thoughts, and they're there because they're habitual. This torturer, he said from the time he was tiny, he was compelled to torture the creatures. It just kind of happened, you know, and that's what programming is, from his own past karma. Just the same as that little boy whom I mentioned, the son of my friend, who cried with compassion for the lice in his own head as his mummy is trying to take them out. He didn't know. He didn't learn. It was just spontaneous because he had he trained his mind in kindness and compassion. And he's like 40-something now, and he's never killed a living being in his life. Because we can deduce from this, the Buddhist view, he'd trained himself in the wish not to kill, not to harm, and to have compassion. There he was with lice, spontaneously crying with compassion for the lice. He'd programmed his mind. So when we realize that what goes on in the mind, which is so powerful for us, which runs us in this way and that, can be harnessed. It is ours. We need to hear them. We can't bury them. We can't deny them. It's scary because we take them so concrete. It's terrifying sometimes. We believe we're a monster, so people kill themselves sometimes because they can't bear the pain of their own thoughts, the dramas in their own minds, you know. It's horrifying, but they're thoughts. So we have courage enough to access our good thoughts, our virtues, our positive habits, and let them have a big voice in our life, not just buy into the rubbish thoughts every time. Which ones are the ones that are the most compelling? Because we're so habitual. That's why they're habitual. Because we practice them more. That's why it's easier to be angry than be patient, if that's your tendency. But it's not set in stone, because you can change it from being patient to anger. It takes time. But we have to realize that the thoughts are only thoughts, insofar as they're just habits. Groove you've dug in your mind. They're habits. They're not physical. They're mental. We can change them. Conditions are very strong, and that includes our body and our brain and our chemical makeup, which make it much harder to do that. But we can. We can do it. We can do it. This is the point. One step at a time, fearlessly. Which means we have to see our mind really clearly. If you're not well, and you go to the doctor, and you know they say you've got cancer, you just don't pretend you've haven't got cancer. Oh, I don't look, no, go away, I don't want to know about it, which is how we are. We can't bear to go there and pretend there's no cancer. Well, it's a joke, you know. It's just a joke. You've got to see the disgusting cancer. You've got to look at it for what it is. Know the causes and know the solution. Denial is not helpful. But what our thoughts and our actions and our habits are so sometimes quite heavy that it is just overwhelming for us because we think they're concrete, because we think this is who I am. Because the more instinctive it is, the more we believe it is who I am in my bones. This is why what I was saying before, how we define ourselves, I am this kind of person, whether it's in terms of race or gender or our mental habits. This is what paralyzes us, you know. This is why the idea of reincarnation is bizarre if we have this view of even race and gender being so powerful. Or forget about species, you know, they're even more powerful. But they're just conditions. The species, whether you're a rat body or a human body or a white body or a black body, they're just certain conditions, karmic conditions created by us to be in a particular environment at a particular time, to be that particular person with a particular history we have with people and the responses we get with people. It's all very dynamic, and we're all equal participants, in other words, in this scenario we all live in. We are the creators of our own reality, and we are the creators of why we're in this reality, with this particular people, seeing me this way, loving me this way, hating me this way. It's an intense one. But this is infinitely superior than the view that says I'm this innocent victim plonked into this maniac movie that I have nothing to do with. No wonder we live in fear. You see my point? Whereas I know I'm a participant in this movie, I'm one of the creators of this movie, this life of mine. It's very powerful, and it makes you more brave and courageous. It stops the blame, it stops the victim, and it helps you change. But it just takes time, you know. Then you begin to welcome everything, even the rubbish. You know why it's coming. Hi there. Hi there. Hi, enemy. Welcome home. Hi. And then you welcome the friends, too, and are delighted in your past virtue. You delight in your virtue. Any good thing that happens, you delight in your virtue. So like I said a couple of days ago, actually, if we look really mechanically at it, every single second of the day, if you track your day internally in terms of good feelings and bad feelings, okay, forget the neutral ones, pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings, track throughout the day. Then if you want to be really technical about it, every one of those good feelings, and remember those 64 moments in a 64 moments in a finger snap, every one of those that you call a good feeling, each one of them individually, each one individually is a fruit of a virtuous seed you planted in the past in your mind stream. Every moment that you call suffering, unpleasant feelings, is a fruit of a past negative action. So maybe unpleasant feelings last for 5 days, non-stop, with your nightmare going crazy in your head, with the sickness and the fever and the hallucinations and the misery and the horrible people harming you or torturing you. Maybe unpleasant feelings for years. Maybe you can't even trigger a pleasant feeling. Or the alternative, you don't have many unpleasant feelings because not many bad things happen. Your mind is quite peaceful because you've worked on it. You've got good karma, you've got good friends, you've got good environment, you've got good scenario, and you're having pleasant feelings all the time. I mean, it seems amazing. It's perfectly possible. Every one of those is a fruit of your past virtue. Every bit of good things that happen to you. And we all have plenty of that, actually. But we just don't remember. We forget. Then when we realize this, like if you look at your beautiful garden and you've worked on it for 50 years and you see these amazing things and the daffodils and the flowers and the olive trees and the gorgeous oak tree and gardens are exquisite, these beautiful things. You can see the work that someone's put into it. And if you look at it and you forget that you grew it, then you'll just take it for granted. Oh, what's that kind of garden out there? Huh, who did that? Nothing to do with me. How tragic. It's the fruit of your hard work. Then you would appreciate every tiny violet, every tiny little daffodil, every little shift in the glass. You'd see it and appreciate it because you remember you created it. So then you wouldn't want to waste it and you'd want to grow more, wouldn't you? Because you know you've got to keep moving on it every day and pulling out the weeds and keeping it beautiful. Great analogy for our lives, you know. But we take for granted the good that happens to us. We have in our lives people, since we're born, who've been good to us, kind to us, generous, done this, done that. We might think of plenty of bad things as well. But we tend to become overwhelmed by the bad. Remember our bad qualities. Remember the bad people. But we're not looking at all the good things. So then we don't appreciate. Therefore we don't value. Therefore we don't realize what the causes are. Therefore we don't do more of it. And we just become overwhelmed by self-pity and misery and not fair and poor me. So my feeling is that we really can own responsibility for the good stuff. It's easy then to own responsibility for the bad. But if we keep going about the bad all the time, we get completely miserable sometimes, get depressed, you know. Get obsessed with that. And that's the irony of ego. It loves negativity. Ego loves negativity. Okay, so let's look at purifying negative karma. Any questions first? Yes, Diane. What, sweetheart? Give her the mic, please.
It's just, I don't know what anybody else thinks about it, but this thinking in another way.
Yeah.
As far as attachment goes, uh-huh. And just the whole nature of attachment,
uh-huh.
It seems to invalidate what we term as romantic love completely. I mean, it invalidates every love song I ever heard. It just sounds like attachment to me.
I understand. It is. You're right.
I can't breathe without you. I'm going to die if you leave.
That's right.
If you listen to the love songs. So my question is there any such thing as romantic love?
I
mean, that seems like it's not real.
I understand. So, okay. This is whether it's romantic love or enjoy a chocolate cake, the same principle. It's the same principle because it's an object that triggers a good feeling, yeah? And then attachment takes over and exaggerates it and believes it's the cause of my happiness, so I've got to keep shoving it in again. That's the same with whether it's Fred or the cake. When you really look, do you understand my point? There's,
yeah.
No, honey, I understand. I'm trying to answer the question.
Okay, I'm going
to go into it, I promise. Mm-hmm. I'm going to unpack it. Okay. The same principle applies. It's the exact same scenario. Whether, in fact, even it's the guy who's the fisherman, the one who likes the cake, or if you like, the handsome boy. The same thing applies. But the difference is degree. That is all. So all you're saying, okay, so there's my, okay. So there's my, I always quote this friend of mine in Greece, Panos. You must have heard me say this before. This boy, when he was six, he told me, walking down the street in Athens, and he saw this poster of this lady in the cinema, half naked. And he goes, with a little voice piping up loud, his Greek Orthodox mummy in the street, "Mummy, why is my penis standing up?" So this is the point, okay? So whether you're the torturer was Jeffrey Dahmer. Remember the guy called Jeffrey Dahmer years ago? He's this torturer. There you got a guy called Jeffrey Dahmer who was a torturer, who saw creatures from the time he could remember, and he was compelled to torture it. Why? Because it triggered a very good feeling. The fisherman saw fishing, and he ran like a magnet. Why? Because it triggered a very good feeling. Panos sees a girl on a poster. And his little business stands up. A very good feeling. I don't think the fisherman's little thing stood up. Maybe Jeffrey Dahmer's did, definitely. But get my point here, please. So they're all, the cake. Your thing doesn't stand up for the cake, believe me. But you get excited and you go, oh, I put it in the mouth. So the point is, the way karmic imprint, habit, causes you to meet the object, recognize it, triggers attachment, makes it look delicious, and you run to it, and then it triggers a good feeling. So all we're talking romantic love is this wonderful, dramatic scenario that we have built with lovely clothing and pretty things and all the seduction, all the outcropping, yes, of attachment. But still there are the good feelings there. That's perfectly valid. And there happens to be in those relationships some love, if we're lucky. But the trouble is, where the murders of women on this earth, 40% of all women who get murdered, guess where it's in the romantic relationship. And that ain't because of love, baby. The downside of it also is because it's attachment. So all of it is because of attachment. So that's what we've got to analyze, each experience, and analyze what's attachment, what's pleasure, what's this. Understand the nuts and bolts of what's going on, you know. So all a romantic relationship is this deep instinctive yearning for happiness that then dumps itself onto, with attachment, onto a person. If you're a straightforward, common old person, it'll be a person. I mean, if you're a furry, these people who are attracted to stuffed animals, please hear my words, they get their kicks from having sex with a stuffed animal. Look up on the Google. I read an interview in Vanity Fair, the same for them, because they've got a habit of attraction. Listen, a person who becomes a furry in this life, they say from life to life, habits multiply a million times, okay? So if you, all your life, you struggle against attachment to food, this life is a struggle until you die. But next life, you'll be completely free of all attachment, it'll completely purify your mind. You'll have not a single thought of attachment for food. If you've given up killing in this life, you'll have no tendency to kill in the next life. If you've practiced attachment, let's say, this is not meant to be joking, toys, look at us with obsession with toys and pets and cartoons. Personified people, personified animals, okay? And look when we're little children with our vividly creative minds, and creativity is a function of attachment, very strongly connected. So there you are, programming your mind with attraction to animals, attraction to pets, attraction to, look at it, how intense it is in our culture. That's called attachment, but it doesn't manifest any special way in this life, because you're mostly in this life, you're living out what you did in the past life, but you're putting new seeds in your mind. Well, guess what you'll get next life, honey? You're quite a nice person, you're a good little Christian. They say most of the furries are vaguely gay, white Christian, vaguely gay, white technicos, IT people. Don't ask me why, but I read these stories about it, okay? Don't ask me. The point is, this fellow who's a furry, they're all computer geniuses for some reason. They're all techies, and they're vaguely gay, except they prefer sex with an animal. With a toy. Okay. So guess what? If you're attracted to a pet in one life, you're attracted to your cartoons, you're attracted to your little cute pet and your stuffed animal. I mean, we many people prefer their pets. Be careful, you people. So you get virtue ripens the time of your past death, but guess what you're going to have intense attachment for? Not torturing, not wanting a girl. Panos was old-fashioned. He liked a girl. He was normal. supposed. What attracted him, made his thing stand up, was a girl shape with little lumps here and a couple of spaces there and a few limbs. I mean, look at us. We're like a joke. But there's a person with addiction to animals, which in this life has multiplied hugely. So this boy, since he was seven, he said six or seven, went to the sports. And it wasn't the girls who turned him on, you know, the dancing girls. What do you call them? I always forget the name. What do you call them? Cheerleaders. They didn't turn him on. It was a stuffed toy. It was Mickey Mouse mascot. Are we communicating here? You won't read this in the Buddhist text, okay? But I'm extrapolating. I'm trying to unpack how attachment works and habit and karma. Okay, so you're born, and so this little boy, he was attracted sexually to the Mickey Mouse mascot. Jeffrey Dahmer was attracted to torturing. The fisherman was attracted to killing. Panos was attracted to a girl. So it depends on what culture you come from, which is considered normal. A boy in the prison in France, his brother and him, the psychologist was telling me about it, when she used to go and visit, they killed one of the girlfriends to eat her heart. They were attracted to eating a human heart. Okay? So whatever turns you on, baby, but all of this is, Buddha says, is from past habit, and then attachment to it, and you build it up, and you build it up, and you build it up. So the normal old-fashioned idea of romantic love, as you're talking, is just the way we've institutionalized and humanized a little bit, if we're fortunate, don't turn into the 40% who get murdered by the romantic partner when it goes downhill. We just institutionalize because we're clever humans. I mean, dogs have romantic love, but honey, they just go boom, boom, and they're finished. They eat their food off the floor. In 1 minute, they're really straightforward. But we do all the drama and the creativity and have to pay fancy houses and bedrooms with sheets and dishes and spend our lives just making it cute. And then we go kill ourselves, each other, because it turns into sour. So, excuse me, where's romantic? I mean, I'm not trying to be horrible. Have a partner. I'm very happy for you. So.
Not after that.
So there's the furry. I read about him in Vanity Fair. He spends all his money on eBay on stuffed toys. He wears his toy animal things. He goes to his hotel, the conferences, they all meet together in their stuffed toys, and they identify with the raccoons here, and I bet they don't identify with the smelly ones, you know, not them. But they're all this romantic, cartoon-like fantasy world. Everything in the mind is like a fantasy that we've made up. We make up these elaborate fantasies around the simple thing of sticking a thing in a hole. Please forgive me, but I'm trying to... Are we communicating? Come on, you asked me. Well,
we're
I'm answering
overly
you.
Overly communicating, Venerable Rabbi.
Pardon? What's she saying? That's right, dear. We've got to unpack these things. Okay, dogs do it like that. Cats do it this way. The furry guy, he said, I tried human-appropriate size real animals like Alsatian dogs, but he didn't like it. He preferred his stuffed toys. Now, this proves emptiness, people. Yeah. There's Panos, because of habit of liking human girl shapes. He's called normal. Oh, and the cinema lady, when she heard him say this, she cracked a joke about how he'll be a lady killer. And sure enough, even when he turned 13, he saved up all his pocket money. And the first thing he bought was not a little toy train, but was a prostitute. He loved his prostitute. He told me he's a nice Buddhist. He's 40 now. He's married. He's probably calmed down, okay? Maybe he's more like 50 now. But the fact is, he loved girls. He couldn't stop thinking day and night about having sex with girls. Well, he's considered normal. Then there's the other one who can't day and night having sex with his stuffed toy. He goes to the shop, buys a meter of felt, shapes it in Mickey Mouse, puts two dots there and a mouth there, and he gets turned on. I mean, if we don't make the universe ourselves, I don't know who does. It's proving we create our own reality. It proves we create our own reality. One boy sees fishing. You know, the poor seal, the baby seal killers. What country do they live in? Yeah. There you go. know. You see, I remember having an interview with one of the baby seal killers, this nice human being, because his daddy did it, his grandpa did it, he's born due to karmic imprints into that culture where you bash a baby seal's head to death. And he can't see the baby seal suffering because he's attached to it. The fisherman couldn't see the fish suffering because he's attached to it. And what attachment does, what I'm saying about before, that attachment embellishes a simple thing. So romantic love is the embellishing over centuries of our intelligence. With our intelligence, we embellish a fundamental action, like I said before. We embellish it, make it look divine. There's all the lead up and the thing and then the culture and the thesis and the meeting the family, the drama all around it. So aren't we fortunate if we can get some good out of this? But of course it's all attachment. Of course it is. But luckily, because we've got some love and some kindness, we also get some virtue from it and have babies and try to be nice parents. But the other part, which causes 40% of the women in those relationships to be murdered by their partners, is because it is attachment. And when attachment goes bad, it turns into the nightmare. So when we can see through the fantasy, then you can, even with a bit of bodhicitta, you can play act it. Because there is pleasure, there is love, there is joy, and there can be out of that, without being delusion, when we've practiced. You can get the best of both worlds. And you'd end up never harming. It would be done with compassion, with joy, with kindness, and you get some pleasure too, like there's the bonus on top. But you would never kill, you would never have sex with an animal, you just wouldn't need to. You wouldn't want to stuff yourself with a lot of cake. You wouldn't want to kill the fish. You wouldn't want to torture, because you've purified your mind. But given that you are a human in this life, on your way to Buddhahood, and you say like a boy, and then you've got some karma to have that boy and have a few babies, then you do it with bodhicitta. That's the advanced level. But that implies you've gone beyond ego, and you can see through the bubble of the attachment, but you play act it. And then there's some pleasure there, and you can use that pleasure. That's the most advanced level. Of course it's all attachment, darling. The whole damn universe is a product of attachment. Okay. Are we communicating?
Thank you for very thoroughly answering the question, Genevieve.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I have a really boring question.
Okay. Go on.
Okay. It's a simple one. I think I had something wrong, and I want to make sure what you said.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure you're right. So if Dan actually kills, poor Dan, accidentally kills the mouse,
uh-huh.
Did you say there's no karma, or is it just lighter
strictly,
karma?
No, strictly speaking, if we analyze it really carefully in a simple scenario, everything is far more nuanced in reality, isn't it? But in a simple technical example, if we understand, that's the main point here, to show the central point in the meaning of karma is that your mind is engaging in the thought to do something based upon a motivation. If his foot stands on a mouse and his mind isn't involved, how can there be karma created? Because mind creates karma. It's a logical deduction.
That's great. I thought there was a lighter karma. Like there was...
Well, it depends on the person.
Yeah.
If he's one of the serial killers, but he's thinking day and night about murdering his next-door neighbour, and he happens to kill a mouse, of course there's going to be negative karma. I mean, his mind's pervaded by the wish to kill.
Okay.
It depends on the thing. It's like so many other things, but just try and get the point. Because we are killing all day, darling.
That's what I was thinking.
We are killing all day. And you cannot say there's karma. It doesn't. If you're just being ignorant and don't care, that's different. But if you learn to be conscious and have the intention of not to kill, that's the beacon that guides you out of the mess of the nightmare of being in samsara where we are harming each other just by existing. At least we can begin to change our mind, and that's what helps. And that's why we have to purify as well.
Right.
Do you see?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
So the antidote or the purification practice for romantic love is unromantic love? No, I'm just asking you. Or killing the fish. Is it I should go to the pond and give the fish food to the pond? Is it? Those are the example antidotes.
I'll talk about it. We haven't discussed the practice yet. I will talk about it. But in general, in daily life, if you're trying to play that note and you do the wrong one, the antidote is to keep trying to play the right one until eventually you got it down. So, of course, if there's a tendency to kill, then one of the most obvious things in daily life to do would be consciously, actively, not kill, but even actively go and help sentient beings, which can be a powerful antidote. It's just the opposite. If you've got a tendency to lie, you not just don't not lie, you actively try to tell a truth. Sort of reprogramming your mind, you know, changing the habits. So romantic love, okay, romantic love means, and the whole world, let's face it, is built on this, sentient beings coming together, we're very social beings. You see, this is a way to talk about... Okay, never mind. Past history, forget that one. Because, okay, now people don't think of sex in terms of having babies. It's just more complicated now. People have... Boys have sex with boys, and girls have sex with girls, and Lord knows what. You know? Whatever. Whatever. It's okay. But the point is, we can see that's a pretty intense attachment, isn't it? Between two people. Or indeed, a person and an animal, unfortunately. What can you do, you know? But if we're going to go into that method, it is the most. It's what I said before. It's more. It's a question of how intense the pleasure is that's triggered. That's how strong. That's all. So the cake, whether it's good or bad action, there's attachment to it, and then the pleasure that it triggers. Do you understand? So the stronger the pleasure that action triggers, the more divine we think the person is. And that's why romantic love is so intense, and why we exaggerate it and build it all up and embellish it and make romantic and dramas, and then we institutionalize all these things as part of our religions even, you know. Not just have a bit of sex and go like the dogs do. We've dramatized it and made enormous novels and plays out of it, and it goes on for centuries. So if we're going to continue to have those things, and people seem to want to, because it's driving, this is what attachment is, it drives us to the most fundamental level, then you try to do it with virtue. You know, you try to do it with virtue. You try to, if you don't have a partner, it's what you feel you want, and your mind is thinking you want babies all the time. Lots of people have this, since they're born, they want babies. It's another attachment. It's not being horrible. It's the drive to have a baby. It's attachment. That's all it is, and you make a plan to have attachment. You make a plan to have a baby. You make a plan to do this. You make a plan. It's called attachment. It's what drives 99% of everything we do and say and think is attachment. So it's lucky and fortunate that we've got some goodness in there that can temper the attachment. And then if we're going to have babies and have romantic love, add the love to the mix so it begins to be a reasonable relationship and get some good out of it. Otherwise, it's just nightmare and goes to hell, you know. Do you understand what I'm saying, people? You try to do the opposite. The best one, Buddha would say the best one, if you want to get out of samsara altogether, is give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Take vows and go to the mountains and get some realization. That's the quickest, most direct method to get some realizations, you know? The most direct antidote. Just give it up. Best, quickest, definite. But 99% of us won't do that. So we do what we can within that, you know? And we try to apply the antidotes every day. Do the opposite. So not unromantic love. Romantic love means love. No, okay, this is where it's even a misnomer. Love for the Buddha is a state of mind under the heading virtuous. You've got non-virtuous and virtuous, negative, positive. Love is an altruistic state of mind that delights in the happiness of another. So that's actually has no relationship to attachment. But our problem is the only person we love are those we're attached to, and the only people we're attached to are those we love. So we assume they should come together. But there's no logic. And that's where we do the compassion wing practice, where you're going way beyond attachment, and you change the fundamental basis for wanting someone to be happy, which is to love them. It's because they want to be happy, not just because they make you happy, which is the basis of our love now. The only one I want to be happy is the one who makes me happy, which is my object of attachment. That's why they keep changing. When Dan gets bored with me and takes me, you know, changes me for a younger version, I'll stop loving him and I'll love someone else, and he will too. So our love right now is really unstable, as Lama Zopa puts it, because it's based on attachment. So it's a load of rubbish, really. So you want love, and you also have attached to the person, when the practice is to love them, to want them to be happy, whether they love you or not. Whether, you know, if they get mad at you or come home late from work or don't appreciate you, you learn to want them to be happy. And then the relationship will develop into something reasonable. Otherwise it will turn into the one of the 40% who get murdered. Because it turns into anger and despair and rage and blame and jealousy and drama when the bubble bursts. This is what's so tragic about it. So in other words, if we could see the romantic fantasy and see the pictures and look at the beautiful pictures and the gorgeous this and the nice lights and blissfully in love, and then you put the, you know, 10 years later, killing each other next to each other, you'd think it's a cruel joke. Someone's being mean and brutal to you. But the fact is, 40% of female people on this earth who get murdered are murdered by that beloved. So this is not meant to make us miserable, but it should show us the horror of attachment. But when it's all the delicious bubble, we can't bear to think of the downside. Just like when you see the delicious cake. You don't want to know about how you feel when you're stuffed with it. You just don't want to go there. It's too depressing. Or you're obsessed with a delicious thing. You're obsessed with getting in the mouth. All you can anticipate is the deliciousness. But you forget every time it brings stuffed stomach. And you're like an animal, you know, stuffed. So attachment can't bear reality. Attachment can't bear reality. It's so hard to see. And can't even see reality when it's really strong. So that fisherman, his mother told me that she never liked fishing. And she went fishing with him one time. And she couldn't bear it. Because why? He saw the same fish flapping in his boat when they got them in his nets. He saw the same flapping fish every day for all the years he was a fisherman. He never once saw suffering. She saw it once and all she could see was suffering. And what's the difference? Because his mind was full of the fantasy of the bubble of what he thought fishing was. He embellished fishing. Do you understand? He thought it was divine. It gave him good feelings. He never saw suffering, like the baby seal killer did not see suffering. That's the tragedy of attachment. It blinds us from seeing truth, from reality. Which doesn't mean reality means it's ugly. It's just that we live in denial. So if attachment is this junkie, we'll do anything to trigger a good feeling. And then we'll embellish the thing to an insane degree because that's what attachment does. It's the creativity in our head. When you're attached to something, you think of it all the time. We know that. And then we pursue to get it. And then we have a nightmare when we can't get it. Or when we lose it. This is what samsara is. And this is the thing, Lama Zopa says, we've got renunciation, which means this recognition of what suffering is and what the causes are. We've got renunciation, finally. When just the thought of another moment of attachment in your own mind, just the thought, and remember we live in it all day, just the thought of another moment of attachment is so disgusting, it's like being in a septic tank. He says different examples. It's so disgusting. When you actually see what attachment is. Which doesn't mean when you see two people looking, being kind to each other, you go, isn't that disgusting? You see two human beings, you have love for them, you have compassion for them, you see they've got goodness, you delight in their happiness. You do. You wouldn't go, oh, look at those disgusting people having attachment. You'd see humans and you'd feel delighted, but you'd see also that they're caught up in the bubble of suffering, believing in the attachment bubble, knowing it's going to bring a nightmare in the future when the jealousy and the anger and the hurt and the distress, the despair and the depression come, which they will if attachment's running the show. It's like seeing a person taking their first shot of heroin. You can see the nightmare coming. So it doesn't mean you get angry with a person. You have compassion. We've got to have it start with yourself. And this just takes time. It takes time. We live in attachment. We're driven by attachment. Our body is the product of attachment. It is the body of an attachment being. So we've got to be very humble and take it very slowly and begin with a simple practice of trying to control, trying not to harm, trying not to steal, do our best and rejoice in our efforts. And meanwhile, try to enjoy your cake and enjoy the boyfriend. But try to see the attachment. Slowly, 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 you know. The aim isn't to get all fundamentalist and think it's all disgusting. That's just turning into aversion. That's wrong. Yeah. It's 3:00. I didn't give you a break. Do you need a break or something? Because I thought I'd just go into the purification practice a bit just to talk about it. We're at 30 minutes. Or should I continue now? Do that? Okay. Yes, go, darling. Yeah. 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 No, go. Go. Yep.
So we go through life and we create these, or kind of gather these karmic seeds. Mm-hmm. How is it determined that those seeds don't ripen until your next life?
They say, in the same way, I mean, they just use analogy of seeds, you know. They used to need an analogy of seeds because there's no seeds, there's no physical. It's just the analogy. The seeds take time to ripen, don't they? So the more certain actions, they say, when they're very powerful, can ripen quickly. But most, it just leaves an imprint. Because right now, what we are, this whole body, this person, all my tendencies, all the experiences I've got, it's sort of like, okay, a flower is the fruit of all the things you did in the past, isn't it? So it's got a certain lifespan, hasn't it? But you know very well all the causes of that flower, are coming from the past. You accept that, don't you? And it's now just living out the stuff that you need to put the seed in, the water, the soil, the angle of the sun, and now you can see the flower ripening. So from the moment the flower begins to ripen, it's the fruit of everything you did in the past. You can do a little bit of, you know, pruning on it and maybe a bit of sunlight, but there's only so much you can do with it. There's not much, is there? You know, you can cut it off and kill it, but it's just going to, it's acting out the past things. The flower, that's all. Well, humans the same. You, everything about you is the product of a million different things you've done in the past. You've come into this life as this shape. So, you know, if killing will ripen as a tendency to get killed, it will ripen as you getting killed, it will ripen as you being born as a dog, it'll ripen as living in a disgusting environment. If you in this life are experiencing the fruits of virtue in the past, living in a nice environment and you're healthy and fat and you know, from virtue in the past, that'll take time to wear out. Then the new things you're doing are sowing new seeds in your garden, which will ripen as new fruits in the future. I mean, you don't turn into a dog the moment you kill. And you don't necessarily, a person who say, okay, you know, there's one kind of karma called the experience when it happens to you. There's another one called when you do it yourself. So let's say you have a tendency to lie. Let's say. And that's one track of your karma from habit, and it ripens as a habit. Then the other one is to be lied to. But you might not get lied to in this life because that track is not the one. You've got the strong track from another part of your past life to where you've told the truth, so you'll only be always spoken the truth to. So because you lie now, it doesn't mean you're going to be lied to tomorrow. But if you are lied to tomorrow, we tend to think, oh, well, there's karma, instant karma. It's not. What happened was you had a karmic seed to be lied to, and to your lying today helped nourish it. But it was already there. So seeds just take time to manifest. New shape of person takes time to grow, you know. And then it multiplies strongly when it does manifest in the new product, the new person. I mean, that's how they talk about it, you know. So, okay. The purification practice is, if we create karma by our thoughts and our actions, you know, and especially the thoughts, then we can purify karma by changing our thoughts. So the four main steps, really. The first one is, and it's called the four R's, and it's going to be in this notes you'll get tomorrow, and many of you know it already. The first one is regret. The second is reliance. The third is the remedy, and the fourth is called resolve. It's an easy way to remember the four R's. So, okay, what is regret? Well, in just the same way, and it's always a perfect analogy, that you say, you know, you've eaten poison. They use this analogy, and it helps. Because you know you're eating poison will ripen in the future as your suffering, you know that. You have to know that first. Then when someone points out that there's poison in your dinner, then what the response you'll have is what they mean by regret. Oh, my God, what an idiot. I don't believe it. Quick, where's the doctor? Is this not what you do? You know poison will bring you future suffering. You know you don't want suffering. You just did something that will cause you suffering. You think, bloody hell, I must change this immediately. Quick, where's the doctor? Is it not true? This is what you do. Well, that's the attitude here. It's very simple. So it's taking the same logic that everything you think and do and say, well, that's called negative, and we define that in certain ways, will produce your future suffering. This is, again, it's abstract because it won't happen immediately. And that's why you can see when you're young and fit, and you're smoking your cigarettes, and you're ingesting the heroin or the speed or whatever it might be, you know, you don't see the result immediately. You don't. It's later that you see your lungs are ruined. You don't see the result immediately. So you become very arrogant when you're young. You think you're not going to get sick. You're not going to be a junkie. No, not me. We don't see the consequence. We can see other people who are overweight from too much eating, who are junkies now because of heroin. But because attachment blinds us. We don't see the consequences. So therefore we don't acknowledge that we did something wrong because we're so desperate to do it again. So the first one is to see objectively, to hear, to think about killing and lying and stealing is the poison you're putting into yourself that will ripen as your future suffering. And you've got to analyze, I don't want suffering. It does seem abstract to us because we can't see it. It's not evident to us. That's why we're taking this view on board as our hypothesis. It has to be. So the first thing is you've got to be driven by the thought, I don't want suffering. That means not only lower realms, but it means the habit to keep doing it and to have it done to you. These are, or the environmental, at least these. And the fact is we know we don't like suffering. If you see what you're having today, when someone's mean to you today, you don't like it. When someone lies to you today, you don't like it. When someone tries to harm you, we know we don't like suffering. So even that kind of suffering we can use as our basis. Maybe you don't understand, you can't get the idea of being a rat, but at least you know you don't like being harmed by others. And if you're taking the basic logic that killing and lying and stealing, one of the consequences, well, it'll happen to me, then you can be very real when you say, I regret that because I don't want the future suffering. You can say that tastily. And you know you don't. So then you're using this as your basis. So therefore, regret is like compassion for yourself. Regret is recognizing that'll harm you. It's not guilt. It's got nothing to do with guilt. That we are really good at. But that's just rubbish. Guilt is self-blame. Guilt is, imagine if you said, oh, I ate poison, and I'm such a bad person. Oh, I'm so guilty, I ate poison. You're getting sicker and sicker every day, and it never occurs to you to think, what can I do about it? Because you're sitting there feeling miserable. That's guilt. It's useless. It's a completely useless state of mind. This is accountability. I don't want suffering. This is not just compassion. Compassion comes second. You've got to have it for yourself. There's got to be this accountability that whatever you do, say, and think will leave an imprint in your mind that will ripen as your suffering or your happiness. It's accountability. And this just takes time. Because we're used to the blame mode. We're so used to believing that if I do something bad and no one sees me do it, that we get away with it. That's the bizarre view we have of morality. It's as if the doctor says don't smoke, because you get cancer, Rabina. And I go home and I go, oh, my doctor's not here. She won't see me smoke. I won't get cancer. I mean, people will laugh at you. Well, that's how we are with morality. It's very childish. So this one takes time to have the sense of accountability. But my suffering now is the fruit of my past negativity. And, hey, baby, I don't want more suffering, so I'm going to change. It really means growing up, you know. It's fearless. So the first one is regret, which means acknowledge the things you did today, for example. You start with the things you did with your body and speech to harm others. Then you look into your mind. And the rubbish, the attachment, the rage, the hurt, the jealousy, the resentment, the stuff that is breaking your heart and harming you daily and that will produce the actions you do later with your body and speech. You regret because you say, I regret it because I do not want suffering. You've got to say that, otherwise it just feels like guilt. Then, of course, because you know your mind's going back and back and back to beginningless time and you've had billions of lives and done billions of actions and billions of negative things billions of times, you take this on board, you might as well regret the loss. Whatever I've done in this life and since beginningless time to harm any living being with my body and with my speech, I regret from the depths of my heart because I don't want these seeds to ripen as my future suffering. That's how regret is. It's big. It's great. It's delicious. Then you think, whom can I turn to? Where's the doctor? Best. So things like that. Second step, reliance. You rely upon the Buddha. He's our doctor. In this context, we use the Buddha. And that's a good analogy for our relationship with the Buddha. Like a mentor, like a teacher, like a doctor. Not a creator. Not a creator. Not a creator. So in this context, it's like the doctor. And there's two things that cause you to want to go to a doctor. Same here to the Buddha. You've got to know they're a good doctor. That means you've got to read what Buddha says and have some confidence that he's a regular person, that he's a valid person, that his teachings are valid, because his teachings is the medicine that you apply. And the second is you've got to know you need his medicine. You don't go to a doctor if you're healthy. But hey, if suddenly you've discovered you've eaten poison, you'll go to the ends of the earth to find the doctor who's got the antidote. So that's the basis of refuge. You've got to know you want the medicine. You've got to know you don't want the sickness. Then you will rely upon that doctor's medicine. You will rely upon that doctor's advice. That's the basis of refuge. So in this context, in the practice, you visualize above your head the Buddha, blah, 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 whatever. Then the second part of reliance is where you think of compassion now. And they use the concept of reliance in the sense that now you want to cultivate compassion. The first one, regret, is like compassion for yourself. Now we have compassion for those we've harmed. And we need to have suffering sentient beings in order to have compassion. You can't have compassion, which is the wish that others not suffer, if you don't have suffering sentient beings. So that's why they call it reliance. We rely upon suffering sentient beings in order to generate compassion. So now you think of those you've harmed today, yesterday, this life. And then since beginningless time, all the sentient beings you've ever harmed. You have compassion. You think, I must purify for their sake as well as mine. And then if you're brave enough, you can have compassion for those who've harmed us. And why would we have compassion for those who've harmed us? It's because they will suffer in the future because of the harm they have done. So if we're brave enough, we can have compassion for them as well. I must purify for their sake as well. The third step is you do, you know, there's a whole, you apply the antidote. And here, with the remedy. So there's a million different practices we can do, but there's this particular one in the Tibetan tradition that's praised by all the lamas. And it's the visualization of a particular Buddha, Vajrasattva, and a recitation of his mantra that is said to be the most potent of medicines, you know. This actual practice, the visualization and using mantra. Nothing cosmic. It's your mind. It's your mind engaging in things. It's all something mystical. And that's, you know, you visualize, you say the mantra, blah, blah, blah. We'll do the practice at some point. Then, fourth, the most important, is resolve. The decision to not do it again. So obviously you can't lie to yourself like Lama Zopa says, and you don't lie and say, I'll never get depressed again, I'll never get angry again, I'll never have weird thoughts again. That's too intense. You can't say that. You're going to lie to yourself. You get upset. You can't do that. Be realistic. But certain things, when you begin, like say, to live a life of a Buddhist, if you choose to, you can decide, I will never kill again. I will never lie. I will never cheat. I will never this. I'll never that. You can decide the ones you want to commit to. And the point about this is that when you, because what's in your mind runs the show, and if you say, even when you have an intention, the stronger the intention, I will walk out the door, no one's going to be surprised that my legs will pick me up and walk me out the door. Isn't it true? It's so obvious it's a joke. If I'm sitting here really having an intention, I'm going to sit and relax, believe me, my legs will not pick me up. I promise. You understand my point? It's sort of so obvious it's a joke. So the intention is the thing that runs everything. As Lama Zopa says, everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought. When we know this, we can use this, this is how we become powerful. So this step is when you've decided, let's say, to be a Buddhist, let's say, and you've decided, not even taken the vows yet, which we'll discuss later. You've decided even to use the checklist of 10 don'ts that Buddha lays out. You're going to decide, I won't kill, I won't steal, and I won't cheat on my partner, and take out someone else's partner, free of the body. And then the four of the speech, I won't say harsh words, I won't talk bad things about people behind their back, I won't just rabbit on about nothing, and I won't say lies. Four things of the speech, which we humans are very good at. So you might decide. You decide to use those 10 as your basis for your life. And you decide, today, I will not do them again. And then tomorrow, what will you do? You'll sit down and do the same practice. And you'll say, I'll never kill again. Then the next day, you'll say, I'll never kill again. Well, guess what groove you're digging in your mind? It's like playing the piano. You keep getting better at it. Something cosmic. And that's what protects you from having to kill, lie, steal. You train your mind in a new habit. This little fisherman boy didn't do that. That's why he woke up in this life with the intensive, instinctive habit to kill. And then followed it for the rest of his life until he died scuba diving at 29. And he had the experience of the fruit of killing, which means he got killed. So the four steps. You acknowledge the rubbish, because you can't bear the thought of the future suffering. You know, you turn to the doctor and you have compassion for those you've harmed, the ones you've harmed you. You do a practice to purify and then you vow never to do again. This is how you change your mind. This is how you purify your mind. This is how you mold your mind into a new shape. And it's your mind doing it, step by baby step. Lama Zopa says we're insane not to do this every day. And it's so practical. It's so practical. And it's you becoming your own best friend. That's the way I like to put it. You see, we're so used to thinking of guilt and shame and bad girl and good girl, we're desperate for someone else to forgive us, to get us off the hook. Even if I'm in my relationship with Dan, if I'm mean to him and I shout at him yet again, all I'm panic-stricken about is he's going to reject me. Mostly it's attachment to him. It's terrified he might give me up. I also am sorry I hurt him, but I'm frantic to get him to forgive me again. Then I feel better, don't I? But until I vow never to do it again to myself, I will keep doing the same problem. So forgiveness is not enough. It doesn't change us. It's kind of him to forgive me. It makes me feel better. It suits my ego. But it lets me off the hook. I have got to make changes in myself. Otherwise, nothing will change. It's up to me. And this is where it's so tragic. It's like many people who you think of purification as forgiveness, like some of my friends in prison who've killed people, they despair because the person's dead. The person can't forgive them. And if they think purification is forgiveness, they think they're lost. They give up on themselves, you know. So the fact is, let's say I'm mean to Dan, and he might not forgive me, he might stop forgiving me. That doesn't mean I'm an evil person. If he doesn't forgive me, it's very hard, but I can still make changes. So forgiveness is a bonus, but often it can be helping the ego get off the hook. And it's nothing in this context, it's got nothing to do with purification. As I say, Buddha would forgive you, he's a nice person, but that's not his job. Of course he does, he's got infinite compassion. But it's not the point. It's a personal process each of us has to go through. It's a totally personal thing, this purification process. Acknowledging and regretting the things I've done that will harm others because I'm sick of the suffering it will bring to me. Having compassion for them during the practice and vowing to change. So we can do that incrementally. We've got to be realistic to ourselves. Okay, for a day, I'll try it out. I won't kill for 24 hours. See how it goes. Then at some point we get to where we say, I will never kill again. And then you take vows eventually, which makes it very powerful for your mind. So any questions about that process?
When we regret things from the past, our other lives. And when we do the remedy,
as well as this
current, anything we remember.
The logic is that the seeds are in your mind already, so you've got to first regret and acknowledge. Yeah.
I see. When we're done with the remedy and we do our resolve, are all of our past seeds gone?
Oh, God, you'd be Buddha if they were. You'd be a blissful being manifesting throughout the universe in millions of bodies, benefiting all sentient beings right there.
Well, that's not me.
That's right. It's a slow process.
So some of them.
The first level of it. No, it's not like that. It's like all our delusions, really, and the habits are like big oak trees. They're massive. They're deeply, deeply, deeply grown deep in our mind. So the first level is to begin to harness the energy of the body and speech to attempt to refrain from building on all the rubbish. And that's pretty powerful. So then the purification process, especially with the use of the mantra and the visualization, any of the practices that use the Buddha are said to be very potent. It sort of puts like a forest fire on the seeds. It calms them down a bit. It prevents them from growing. Until you realize emptiness, they will never go totally. It's only when you finally realize emptiness, which we have to talk about. Is it the same topic tomorrow? What's the topic tomorrow?
No.
Oh, it's Sunday.
Yeah.
Oh, so we finished today on this.
Yeah.
Oh, we haven't finished at all. What to do?
So.
Okay, until you realize emptiness, you don't finally remove all the seeds. And that seems a bit abstract at the moment to us, but we have to talk about that later.
That's what I wanted to know, though, so we're controlling.
You're controlling it, you're harnessing it, you're putting the forest fire on, you're sort of burning down to before they can explode into life. You're preventing them from growing, and you're cultivating new fruits and new seeds so the virtues will get ahead of the game and they will grow. The negativities are still there until you finally uproot them completely from all your most advanced practices. So it's like it's a controlling of it, weakening the seeds and giving us space to grow the good habits.
Thank you.
You see my point?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, we can go into emptiness then, okay. Which I meant to do it today, but what to do. So what else? Oops, so daisy. I'm a bit of a fidgeter, aren't I? What else is there? Who is there? Talk. Nobody else? Say something. Huh? You should have ambient, like microphones. You just talk and it comes, you know. All these machines, ridiculous. Go on, talk to me.
I'm trying to understand.
Where are you?
I'm back.
Oh, sweetheart, go.
Hi. I'm trying to understand. Perhaps I need to generate. I probably need to generate regret for my attachment to, say, food, or. But I don't. I guess I don't understand. Some attachments seem more benign than others. Like the attachment to killing, uh-huh, or the attachment to harming. You know, I can understand
that's
the attachment to follow. I don't understand what the karmic repercussions are or what the downside is.
The
following attachment to, say, romantic love or to.
So hang on, stop. So you don't see the suffering that will be caused by being attached to a person. Is that what you're saying? You can't see the downside.
Right.
Okay, have you ever heard of anger?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of anger?
Yes.
Jealousy.
Yes.
Did you hear me quote the number that 40% of women on earth who murdered are murdered by their romantic partner? Did you hear that?
Yes.
What would be the basis of why that would happen? What's the name of the delusion that would be the basis of why there is anger and jealousy and rage and hurt and killing? What would be the name of the delusion that is the basis of that?
attachment?
Precisely, Petal. So of course you can see the suffering coming from attachment. That'd be ridiculous.
Some attachments just seem more benign or...
Excuse me, did you hear my words? 40% of women murdered on this earth are murdered by their romantic partner. I know your point. But if you see the evolution of that, the evolution of resentment and rage and hurt and bitterness and suffering and rage and jealousy and murder began with attachment. Do you hear that? Well, what's benign about that, baby? What's benign about that? Please tell me. I want to know. Give me some reasoning that I've missed here. What's benign about that? In other words, killing, which you can see is heavy, comes from attachment. This is what's so hard to see, darling. It's why it's so hard to see it. So if we have attachment, of course, on the face of it now, if you see a person attached to eating chocolate cake and a person attached to killing fish, if you compare those two attachments now, you can see one is worse than the other. Of course it is. But the attachment to killing comes from attachment to something in the past, a benign one. So all attachment is the source of all the other delusions. If there were no attachment, there couldn't possibly be killing. It would be an impossibility to have killing. So when we understand the evolution, on the face of it, you can compare two now, one is less than the other. It's true. But when we understand the nature of attachment, I'm not discussing the love between two people in a romantic relationship. That's the fruit of their virtue. That's the cause of their virtue. That's the cause of happiness. That's not the cause of suffering. That comes along with the attachment. So we get blinded and don't see the attachment. Do you see what I'm saying here?
Yes, sir. As someone who's just beginning to work on the mind,
that's right.
If I want to harness and control the body and speech,
yes, that's right.
And I commit not to kill.
You commit
steal.
The main ones, the seven actions of body and speech. It isn't complicated. There's a very simple list of instructions the Buddha gives us to use as our guideline to become a better person. And he doesn't say, don't eat too much cake, because it is less severe than killing and harming. The definition here at the very beginning of a negative action of body and speech, by definition, it is one that harms another. It isn't one that harms you. By harming another, you harm you. But it at least confines it to the grosser level of not harming another. At least that, you start there. That's pretty profound. Then by you lessening the actions you do of harming others, then that naturally has impact upon you and softens your heart and causes you to have less attachment, less fears, less junkie, less harming of you. Slowly, slowly, slowly we grow according to our capacity.
So I might have to get to a more advanced level where I can actually just not kill and steal and lie before I can think about, worry about the chocolate cake and my attachment.
It depends on the person. Maybe some people will have attachment to cake much stronger than ever and they might never kill. You've got to know your own mind, darling. You've got to know our own mind. You see, food is one of the ones 99% of us have. The only thing monks and nuns have left is food, believe me. You don't have clothing. Shoes, you know, a bit like the Arab ladies. Shoes. Someone notices I'm a bit attached to my shoes. They're crummy old shoes, but I notice shoes, you know. Oh, yeah, that's a nice shoe. I can't, you know, change my shirt. Well, I choose not to. Hairstyles are pretty much the same. So what else is there but food, you know? You understand? So we one step at a time, darling. Just one baby step at a time.
Thank you.
And delight in your progress.
Thank you.
God, who else? Yeah. Dan has a say. Yeah.
I have a simple question.
Okay, sweetie.
When you look at remedies, would it be that a puja would be a more effective remedy than, say, for example, if I steal, than if I'm generous to others?
I understand. It's an interesting point, Dan. Okay, let's just talk about... This is what we've got to think about, because it just sounds like religion, you know. They say that any action that we do that brings in the Buddhas, brings in, like, the Buddhas, and that's things like this, has more power, has much more potent more potent medicine. They say like that. So absolutely the one of being generous, for sure. But even that depends. You can be generous, give $1 to one beggar, or you can give $1 to a thing, place like this that helps people's minds. Not because it's Buddhist, but if it helps people's minds, that's a more powerful object of your action. So you'd get far more, you would get more benefit from that one. It's like you get more return on your investment if you give $1 to this place. So that level of generosity would be a very powerful antidote. Even more than, you know, saying you bring in the Buddhas and do other things and you get a whole pile of other people to do things. So the more, it's sort of like you can qualify and quantify them. You can. We've got to think about that. But in general, this is why the third step in this practice is using the Buddha, visualizing and saying certain mantra. That all the lamas would say mantra, even just mantra, are incredibly powerful medicines. They're these sounds that by saying them you purify your speech, you even can purify your body by saying them. And they're invoking the presence of the Buddhas. The Buddhas are a very powerful being who are enlightened, blah, 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 blah. So any practice that bring them in give more power, more oomph to the practice. In general, the Tibetans would say that. Yes, they would say that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That question of attachment and mara, you gave an example.
Uh-huh.
So let me put it this way. Attachment is the root cause, but a lover kills his lover because this attachment turns into anger.
That's
or
right.
Fear.
That's right.
Fear
hurt.
Of loss.
That's right.
So basically, there are lots of emotion goes up. So it's not the pure attachment, but that's the root cause.
The root cause, yeah.
And eventually, that fear of losing.
Yes,
anger,
that's right.
That's
exactly right.
That's,
so in other words,
that's, the right
that's exactly right. So attachment, yeah, and even beneath attachment, we have the root delusion, which is the clinging to the ego, which is even more subtle. But effectively, in day-to-day life, this attachment, which runs us at the subtlest level, it propels our mind to go to the next thought. It propels us to do things every single day. It drives us. And then, of course, we have strong attachment. We have the romantic notion, the dramas, the fantasy, the story, the whatever it is. And then when it's thwarted, especially in the close one, that's where the most pain is. It's obvious, you know. It's the most pain. It's unbearable, the pain in relationships, the loss, the tragedy, the jealousy, the hurt, the resentment, and the rage and the grief. And then, of course, anger is a natural consequence. So as one Lama put it, as I say all the time, anger is a response when attachment doesn't get its wishes fulfilled. This is why it's so painful, unbearable pain in relationships. So much... Yep, exactly. When it's all in the beginning, the romantic one, the notion, the picture, the beauty, the lovely, the flowers, the party, the shining, the gorgeous. Because when you are in love, we all know it's probably one of the nicest feelings there is. Everything's dazzling and perfect and gorgeous and everything's miraculous and perfect. The whole universe looks divine. So that's the problem with attachment, when it's very strong attachment, like the romantic love we're talking. It actually causes things to look beautiful. We know the person, the lover, looks the most divine. You can't imagine anything more divine. They're like, it's just like when you're in love, you can't imagine. This person just causes you to faint with pleasure even thinking about them. I remember. Their clothing, their smelly pillowcase. I'll never forget the smell of the pillowcase of the beloved. Are you hearing? I mean, I'm sorry I was saying, I know I use over-exaggerated examples, you know. But that's what attachment, and that's why it is impossibly hard to see how it causes suffering. It seems so cruel. When you see two people in love, in the bliss they've never known the likes of. People even talk about it in religious terms. Seeing the universe, oneness, it's incredible. But we don't, that's why we have to be technical in understanding what is pleasure and what is attachment. Technically, they're separate things, absolutely separate. But the thing is, we never have a moment's pleasure without us being triggered by some attachment object. That's why we assume they're the same thing. Be with me, people. Yeah. And that's why we find it inconceivable to think of having a blissful mind, to be blissful without having an attachment object. And this is Buddha's point, which sounds to us so boring, we can't believe it. I'll tell you, okay, I quote this all the time. My friend, a Swiss monk, who's a meditator, he does retreats, years and years of retreats, a really great practitioner, a bodhisattva, who knows. So he told me years ago, 20 years ago when I first interviewed him in Mandalay, or 19 years ago when I first edited Mandalay. Oh, actually, it's 20 years, 90, it's 14, isn't it? Oh, I came to the States 20 years ago. It's my 20th anniversary as an American. There you go. I'll tell you how I came to this country. I was living in Kathmandu at our monastery, Kopan Monastery. And I was very happy there, editing books and teaching the Western courses and relaxing and enjoying myself out of the way of all the neurotic Western world, whatever, whatever. I was enjoying myself. And I got this note out of the blue from Vajrapani Institute in California. The woman there, who's the director, asked me to come and be the spiritual program coordinator, do the job that Sarah does here. And immediately I thought, oh, God, I don't want to go to the West. I'm quite happy here, thank you. And then I was going to say no, and then I got a note from Lama Zopa. And it said, oh, I've just done an observation. They do this kind of way they check up things. And it comes out very beneficial for others if you go to America, but maybe not much benefit for you. And it's very beneficial for you if you stay at Kopan, but not much benefit for others. But you decide. So I burst into tears, and I ran to one of the lamas and said, oh, I don't want to go to the States again. I don't want to go to America. I don't want to go to the West. I would rather be here, you know. And he said, it's all right, Rabina. If you don't like it, you can come back. It was sort of so easy. I thought, oh, all right, I better do the right thing. So I came. 94, I came here. Anyway, whatever. Never mind. That was what was I saying? 2014. 1994. What was I saying that for? Who? What? Oh, thank you. I think it's called old age. So I interviewed Renee in 1995 in Mandala magazine when I was editing, and this is the point. He said in his meditation retreat, where he's doing these very rigorous disciplined practices called attempting to accomplish single-pointed concentration, which is this technique that really is coming from the Hindus. It's thousands of years before the Buddha, you know, or 1,000 years before the Buddha. It's an amazing technique that enables you to plumb the depths of your own mind, to go to these subtler levels, to remove, to stop completely, even temporarily, the rubbish, the nonsense, the chaos, the messy, the garbage thoughts, the nonsense, the attachment, the misery, the worries, the dissatisfaction that pervades our daily life. You cease those completely in the meditation when you really accomplish it. You've gone to a subtler level. And this is the point, the simple point the Buddha's making. He's saying that the mind, consciousness, when it's unencumbered by the junk, the delusions, it is naturally blissful. It is nature. So Renee said, and he got, maybe he said, this description of the meditation technique is described in terms of 9 stages. And he said maybe in this particular retreat, he perhaps touched on the 5th of the 9 stages, he said. And he said something like, Rabina, there was no question that the joy, whatever word you want, that I experienced in my mind was infinitely superior to any joy I experienced through my senses. And everybody who meditates who has these experiences, that this is the point, they know it's true, but the point is there's no attachment, therefore there's no frantic, there's no grasping, there's no, you know, panic attacks and no puffing and panting and pushing and struggling and shoving cakes in and things and everywhere else just to trigger a moment of pleasure. It's the only way we're like gross pigs, excuse me, I'm my gross examples again, but like those big wild pigs that are waiting for the hot shit under the toilets. You know, you go through the slats of wood, and then it's like this, you know. So that's the only way they know how to get a bit of pleasure. Well, that's like our pleasure. In comparison with the pure, and Buddhists, meaning it sincerely, but don't think of it as religious, but the capacity of the mind to be blissful in its own mind without being encumbered by the junk, by the pollution, by the craving, by the grasping, by the frantic, by the gross body. It's the natural state of our mind to be blissful. And all Buddha's talking about in the long term, getting to really the meaning of happiness, that happiness is what you're left with in your mind, blissful, clear, all compassionate, all loving, all wise, all the qualities inconceivable to us, when you've rid the mind of the pollution, when you've rid the mind of attachment and all the other delusions. That's what you end up with. That's what Buddha means by happiness. And even, this is the 5th of the 9 stages, in a simple technique that even the Hindus taught, well before you realize emptiness, well before you've removed all the junk from your mind, but it's just even a temporary experience. And it's not a grasping, frantic, desperate experience. It's a blissfully clear, calm experience. And that happiness, that bliss, that capacity for it is in our mind right this second. And what prevents us from experiencing it is the presence in our mind of attachment and all the other junk. Single-pointed concentration. It's known these days as mindfulness, and it's actually the technique that's been taught all the time in Buddhist teachings, and it's the classic technique of the first kind of meditation. There are two kinds, and it's the kind that's called single-pointed concentration. And you've got it when you've achieved it to the ninth stage, where your mind is incredibly subtle. All the delusions are completely temporarily ceased. The mind is completely steady. It has gone beyond the gross conceptuality. And if you saw a person in this meditation state, they would look like they were dead because their body's not involved. It's a subtler level of mind. And many people are achieving this all the time. And it's been there since before the Buddha. And the Buddha took this. And it's a crucial technique in the long term. We need to get this so we can do the real work of then removing the junk from the mind, which are all the delusions, which go down real, real deep. Okay? Okay. So, people, one step at a time, okay? One baby step at a time is all we can do. Begin with controlling our body and speech. Then we begin to control our mind. Then we get some concentration. And we do the purification, do all the practice. Then we create virtue. Then we go to the compassion wing. Then we develop compassion, bodhicitta. Then we become a Buddha eventually. One step at a time. In a nice, orderly, progressive way. And Buddha says we all have the potential. Every one of us. Just naturally. It's just hard work, that's all. It's time to go home. Enough? Any more urgent questions? We didn't finish at all, but what can I say? Just started. Yes, sweetheart.
So I have a question about regression.
Aggression.
Regression.
Which one?
Regression.
What's regression?
Like practicing for a long while, but then you don't have the same results as you used to have. And
I don't understand, sweetheart.
What?
I don't understand what you're telling me.
So, for example, after years of practicing meditation and going to retreats and stuff and dealing with panic attacks and, like, went away, and then, like, after a few years, you know, fears start to, you know...
That's not regression. That's not progression, darling. I have a friend who's been doing serious meditation retreats. Serious. 3 years. 4 years at a time. Unbelievable practice. Disciplined practice for years and years. Purification, prostrations, hundreds of thousands of different things. Amazing practitioner, okay? And at some point, after years of retreat, he began to experience levels of anger and violence and that he had never known. He was terrified by it. And he went to Lama Zopa. And Rinpoche laughed. And he said, fantastic. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. So if you go to the gym and you go to a certain level of practice and you get really fit, then you go to another whole level of practice. You're going to have another level of pain that you didn't believe was true. So we keep going more deep and delusions keep coming more deep and we keep going to deeper levels of them. It's not regression, sweetheart. It's another sign of your purification. You're doing well. Congratulations. I'm serious. We really need to know this.
Thank you.
Really, darling. Rejoice in your progress and pull your sleeves up and get ready for the next level of purification. Do you understand, sweetheart? Okay, if you did stop practicing altogether, then you're right. But you're not. You continue to practice the whole time, it's obvious. So you'd be very happy, sweetheart. It's a sign of progress. It's just like the gym example. It is really a sign of progress. You've got new levels of your own junk. Like I like to quote, a friend of mine in New York went off to do a year's retreat. She said, Rabina, I just began to see my mind. So she did another year, then another year. I just began to see my mind. So way to go, darling. Greet each new level of junk that we see with a happy mind and keep practicing. Okay, time to go home. Honey, it's not enough to finish. What can I say? Can't help it. So we have to do more later. That's it. Done. Yeah. Finished. Thank you, everybody. Then we goodbye. Thank you. Thank you. Shall we just don't sing any prayers. Just delight in our progress. Delight in our one step at a time. Each of us take this where we want to take it. Each of us move at our pace. Each of us knowing we're the boss. Have courage. and never give up. Use every tool we can and never give up, never give up, never give up on ourself. And then we'll have more courage in never giving up and understanding others. But one step at a time, one step at a time, one step at a time. Okay.
And we like to delight in our sponsors as well.
Well done.
We have Paul Hagwood, Venerable Katie Cole, who dedicates May We Not Arise Heresy Even for One Second in the Actions of the Glorious Guru, with faith and respect gained from seeing their goodness, may full inspiration flow into our hearts. Donna Cease, for the ultimate, stable, unchanging happiness of all beings, for our precious teachers who show the way to this happiness and the Dharma that embodies it, may they remain to guide us until samsara ends. And Sarah Cagle, I dedicate whatever virtue I have created from listening to these teachings to the benefit of all sentient beings who have been my mother. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase more and more. And may these teachings shine forever.
Okie doke. Thanks, everybody.